This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moscoane. When our guest was 3 years old, his mother named him Brando Skyhorse and told him that he was the son of an American Indian political activist who had been sent to prison. It was a lie, one of many his mother told him about his family. He lived with his mother, grandmother, and a series of surrogate and stepfathers in Echo Park, a Mexican-American neighborhood in Los Angeles. For a time, his mother supplemented their government assistance by working as a phone sex operator under the name Kara Lee and later Mistress Kara. It wasn't until he was a teenager that Skyhorse learned the truth about his heritage, and later, when he was an adult, he tracked down his biological father. Brando Skyhorse writes about all of this in his moving new memoir, and it's titled Take This Man. He joins us here in our Philadelphia studio. It's a great book. Thank you so much for joining us.
I'm thrilled to be here, Marty.
I'd love to have you read from the very beginning of your
book. I'd love to. Thank you.
You're welcome.
I was 3 years old when my father abandoned me and my mother in my grandmother's house atop a crooked hill on Portia Street in a Los Angeles neighborhood called Echo Park. My mother, Maria Teresa, a Mexican who wanted to be an American Indian, transformed me into Brando Skyhorse, a full-blooded American Indian brave. I became the son of Paul Skyhorse Johnson, an American Indian activist incarcerated for armed robbery, who my mother met through the mail. She became Running Deer Skyhorse, a full-blooded squaw, who traded in her most common of Mexican names for the most stereotypical of Indian ones. My mother was mesmerizing and could make crazy schemes and lies sound electric and honest. Her deception was so good or so obvious, she fooled each of her five husbands, our neighbors, her friends, my elementary school vice principal, even me. I lived most of my childhood without knowing who I really was. All I knew was the power in my own name. Brando Skyhorse, that's beautiful. My biological father, Candido Ulloa, was replaced by a chain of boyfriends and five fathers, one new dad about every 3 years. Along with Paul, whom I first met while he was in prison, there was Robert, a restless, habitual, Aleutian Indian thief, Pat, a restaurant chef with a penchant for disappearing, Rudy, a man who answered a singles ad from a homeless shelter, and Frank, a Mexican-American office straight, what Maria called men who worked actual jobs, who wanted a son but could not marry my mother. The only way to keep them straight was to imagine what actors would play them in a movie made from my life. Paul Skyhorse Johnson, Will Sampson, the American Indian chief from One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Robert, Isai Morales, a hot Isai Morales. La Bamba Isai Morales. Pat, Roseanne-era John Goodman. Rudy, present-day Robin Williams, plus 30 pounds. Frank, I've known him the longest, so I can't imagine him in caricature. If he were asked, he'd say Chris Nilt from Law & Order or Michael Nouri from the movie Flashdance, in that order.
Brando Skyhorse reading from the very beginning of his memoir called Take This Man. So what was your name before it became Brando Skyhorse?
It was Brando Kelly Ulloa, and that was my name until I was about 2 or 3 years old. I'd always been named Brando, but my mother, I guess, was so enamored with the movie Godfather that Pacino was actually on the list of names. So Pacino Skyhorse, you can imagine how messed up I am now. If I'd been Pacino Skyhorse, my God, the book would have never come out.
But Brando Skyhorse is a great name.
It's a phenomenal name, and it sounds so much like an archetype, so that when I've, you know, met people over the years and had conversations about, oh, it's an Indian name, it's like literally the most Indian name you could possibly imagine, because I know that many of your listeners probably remember how active Marlon Brando was involved in the American Indian movement in the late 60s and early 70s, so many people assumed that it was a tribute to him, which in a way it was, but of course my mother being my mother would always take that one step further and would say, well, Marlon Brando was my actual godfather, and of course since he was in the movie The Godfather and so on and so forth. So,
and this all happened when your dad... I mean, it sounds like your mom kind of drove your dad away.
Yeah.
Would that be fair?
Yeah, I think that's an incredibly fair and generous statement. You know, my father was a very simple man. You know, he'd emigrated from Mexico. You know, they were very young people in love, very attractive, looking at the pictures of them when they were together. They were just smoldering, and I could see why there was this sort of intense physical connection. But I think that they found out pretty quickly that there really wasn't much of a connection beyond it, because, you know, he didn't really speak English. You know, he was doing the best he could with a series of menial jobs, and that just wasn't enough for my mother, and it just led to this sort of confrontation mm-hmm. where she kicked him out of the house.
Why was your mother, I don't think there's any other word for it, why was she such a liar? And she was. And she lied, and she lied big.
Oh, she, no, if you're going to lie, you're going to lie big. No, yeah. I think, of course, you know, if you had asked my mother, she'd tell you straight to your face, oh, I'm not a liar. All these things happened, and you would believe her. I think she felt that in order to be extraordinary, in order to be noticed, she had this sort of rock star personality. I think there's a line in my book where I say, like, you know, Courtney Love and my mother really should have, like, met each other, because there's so many similar elements of that personality type, where it's just you want to be the center of attention. And I think that she felt in order to keep people's attention, she had to keep telling these stories that just got bigger and more elaborate and more outrageous. And when I came along, you know, I initially was, you know, so enamored with these stories. I thought, like, wow, my mom can do anything. She's been everywhere. So at first I was, you know, just completely devoted to sharing these stories. And then I became an accomplice. And then when I realized, oh, most of these stories were lies, I tried to deconstruct them. And that's where we kind of got into problems.
Indeed. Do you think she was bored with her life? I mean, that she wanted a bigger life for herself, perhaps for her child?
I think a lot of raconteurs, storytellers, liars, yeah, they have this sort of fabulous idea of where they should be, and they know that they're not there. And basically, there's this feeling that if they just tell the right story to the right person, somehow they're going to be connected to this different way of life that they don't currently have. So I think that was a part of it. And, you know, having done some research on this over the years, I feel that my mom was probably borderline personality
really?
Disorder. I'm
really?
Pretty sure. I'm pretty confident of that. You know, she stayed away from therapists. She never got, you know, she was never on antidepressants or anything. But yeah, I think it was probably a combination of those things. And it just got worse as she got older.
One of the things that she would say a lot was, well, it's never boring.
Which, at least it's never boring. That was her mantra.
Never boring.
Yeah, yeah. And it wasn't. And, you know, that's really kind of the sad thing, though, is that she created all of these dramas. I had five different stepfathers and all of the attendant dramas that you can imagine going with that kind of situation. But at the end of the day, she was saying, I'm never boring. And
yeah.
She wasn't, but she didn't need the lies to be that person.
When you had all these fathers and stepfathers in your life, she wanted you to call them dad. And I kept thinking about that, saying essentially she wanted you to adopt them.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty common thing, at least sort of like, you know, the emails and connections I've gotten from people who, you know, have heard this story. They have similar situations where their mothers will bring in these surrogate fathers and they want to sort of wipe away the entire past life of, like, you know, whether the father took off because, you know, he was a cheater or a liar or whatever. And so you get to reboot with somebody new. And how do you start by doing that? Well, you don't call this guy, you know, Roger, you call him Dad. And that's really the power of that name. And I think my mother was just really intuitive in understanding the power of the word, the power of naming somebody, that basically once I had to call this person Dad, I had to accept him, regardless of what the consequences were.
But then it was Daddy gone.
Then it was Daddy gone, exactly. Basically, they would stay for maybe 2 or 3 years, and then they would realize, wow, this is a really, you know, many of these men had checkered past. They're like, wow, this is too crazy for me, and then they'd take off. And each one of these fathers followed a similar trajectory. First, I hated them. Then I slowly grew to trust them. Then I loved them. And then they took off.
And broke your heart?
Yeah.
Or took a piece of it?
Yeah, they took
them.
A piece of it. I think that's a fair thing to say, because when you're young, it's like that's the only template you have. So when you open yourself up and you say, oh, finally, this person who I really didn't like, he's earned his way. You know, he's earned my respect. He's earned my love. And then he goes, yeah, mm-hmm. Of course.
You write that your mom dated men, and I'm quoting here, like a chess master in a park playing 5 games at once.
Yeah, that's a pretty
that's
accurate.
Quite an image.
That's a pretty accurate description. She was capable of just juggling all of these sort of different men, and you know, you'd be amazed at how many, you know, single available men there are out there looking for women, looking for relationships, looking for connections. And this was pre-internet era, so basically, you know, she would put out these single ads, and you know, she would get like stacks of letters, and it was my responsibility, which of course I loved at first. You know, Brando, here, go through the letters. Pick me a winner.
Pick a dad.
Yeah, pick a winner. And, you know, it was my job to kind of sluice through and get rid of some of the obviously more crazy and objectionable people. But it was fun. It was like another chance for me to have this sort of like idealized life of like, wow, if I just do the right thing, I can find the right man for my mother.
But your mom would make a point with knives. She threw you out of the house on what seemed like a regular basis. A tumultuous relationship.
There were two attempts where my mother basically tried to kill me. One was when I was 5 years old. And
people
don't
often say that.
Yeah,
just,
I know.
You know,
it's
kind of
casual.
Kind of,
you know, basically, this is a lot of years of therapy talking. So this was happened when I was five. And, you know, I had misplaced some, you know, some tickets. And she just went into this rage. And I think that was my first sort of taste of like, oh my God, if I don't do the right thing, this could happen to me. And then the second time, it was on Christmas Day, actually, which probably is why I'm not a huge fan of Christmas. But we got into an argument. By that time, I was already in college. I was already spending time out of the house. And the sad thing about it is that it echoed a scene that basically happened with my biological father. I found my biological father 4 years ago, and he told me about the day that my mom kicked him out, and she came at him with a knife. And it was almost word for word exactly how that scene played out with me. So I tried not to take it too personally.
But was she trying to drive you away? I mean, clearly someone coming at you with a knife.
I think people...
I don't know.
I was pretty stubborn, because obviously I was raised by two stubborn women. No, I think that my mother was trying to drive me away because there was probably a part of her that knew she was not healthy for me and knew that it was not a stable situation. And again, this is a lot of therapy and a lot of years of distance talking, but you know, I can look back on this now with empathy and say, you know, she was in an enormous amount of pain, and she just never really learned how to express her frustrations and channel them into a way that was useful, which in a weird way is part of the reason I was grateful that she found her phone sex job, because it was the one place where she got validation. She was exceptional at her job, and she was proud of it.
And I do want to talk about that about a minute before our first break here. You were a really good student in school.
Yeah, I tried. I mean, basically, you know, I realized if I wasn't a good student because, I was raised by both my mother and my grandmother. And my grandmother really instilled the importance of, you know, books. And, you know, she was the one that took me to the library, Los Angeles Public Library, got me my first library card. She took me to my first bookstore because she wanted me to understand the distinction between borrowing books and buying your own books. I remember the first book that I got, like the first book that I bought that I was excited about, which was A Few Minutes with Andy Rooney. You know, the commentator from 60 Minutes, because she was a huge fan of Andy Rooney. And I realized that if I bought the book and read them pieces to her, I could make her laugh. So having somebody like that say, if you don't go to school, this is what's going to happen. Yeah, it kept me on the straight and narrow.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Brando Skyhorse. We're talking about his new book. It's a memoir titled Take This Man. It's about growing up in a section of Los Angeles called Echo Park. It's about his mom. And after this very short break, I'm going to have him read a section about his grandmother. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
A fresh look at Pennsylvania's distressed cities.
There are a lot of people that really care about this city.
Stories of reinvention as communities face rust or revival.
We will change our neighborhoods with them or without them.
WHYY's Keystone Crossroads, a statewide public media partnership where you are part of the conversation.
There was nothing to look forward to. Now we have some hope.
WHYY.org/Keystone Crossroads. Made possible by a generous grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Here's how to be a good contestant on Ask Me Another, NPR's hour of puzzles, word games, and trivia. Tip one, if you don't know the answer, guess.
Driving Michael Phelps.
Could I say right now that I would totally watch the TV show Driving Michael Phelps?
Remember what show you're on.
That is correct. We're not on Jeopardy, but you're right.
Tune in and shout out answers every week on Ask Me Another.
Saturday nights at 8, beginning August 2nd on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. That smartphone you're carrying is becoming a big billboard. In fact, spending on mobile ads is set to eclipse spending on print and radio for the first time. And the ads you'll be getting are increasingly more tailored to your likes and habits. We'll talk the future of advertising next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane talking with Brando Skyhorse about his new memoir called Take This Man. His first book, The Madonnas of Echo Park, was awarded the Pan Hemingway Award for debut fiction. I would love to have you read a section about your larger-than-life grandmother.
I'd be thrilled to. If every ghetto has a hierarchy, my grandmother June was the unofficial mayor of Echo Park. She collected our neighborhood's stories and bartered them with everyone, whatever their language. She could float with uncommon ease among Echo Park's different worlds and ethnicities, telling dirty jokes to the blood-cloaked Mexican butchers at Roy's Market who'd pull me chicharrones, fried pork rinds, from heaven, the beautiful azure-smocked Latina cashiers at Pioneer Market. My first crush was a black-haired Pioneer cashier named Felicia. The Korean-run video stores in the 1980s that smelled of boiled cabbage, whose owners called her Grandma. The Italians at Capra's Deli, who made the mistake of putting an underwhelming Snoopy fondant on my birthday cake. I don't know what the heck that thing on my grandson's cake is, but that ain't Snoopy. And the Jewish owners of Jerry's Department Store, one of several local businesses that extended our family in-store credit for years of loyal patronage, despite sometimes periods of absence punctuated by a grotesque fight, like the one with the store's matriarch, Shauna, over $10. Now I know why Hitler shoved all the Jews into ovens, my grandmother said, clutching my hand tight, and it's a shame he missed you, too. Grandma, I said outside the store, I don't think you should have said that. Oh, I was just making her day interesting, my grandmother said. Stop taking everything I say so seriously. No apologies later. In a month or two, we were back there shopping like nothing had happened. When the politicians downtown refused to put up a stoplight on Sunset after a child died crossing the boulevard, June rounded up my mother and a friend in a three-woman protest and began randomly stepping out into traffic disruptively until a light was installed. This was how the mayor did business.
And again, Brando Skyhorse reading from his new memoir called Take This Man, and a section about his grandmother, who you call in your book, the man of the house.
Oh, she was. I mean, she basically took care of all the chores. She did all the laundry. We had this this massive jacaranda tree out front, which would shed pulpy blossoms on our front stairs. She swept all the blossoms. She went to the grocery store. If you ever see those little old ladies with those fearsome, like, little carts that they take to the store?
Yes.
You know those women. Yes. That was my grandmother, because it was her house and she wanted it run her way, which was fantastic because it kept her alive. It kept her active. But at the same time, I feel that it kind of coddled my mother, and it didn't allow her to develop some of the life skills that I think would have been necessary to help her, you know, transition into her own life outside the house.
Did you feel like this young boy sort of between these two forces of nature?
Oh, absolutely. Scylla and Charybdis. Scylla and Charybdis. Like, over one here on this side was, you know, my grandmother, who loved old movies and talked about living in Los Angeles. So a lot of my love for the town, the Los Angeles' history, came from her. And she spoke fluent Spanish. So, like, the one clue that I had that I was a Mexican-American and not an American Indian, because I didn't even know that until I was 12 or 13, was that my grandmother would speak Spanish, but I never put it together. I thought, like, oh, she's just really interested in Spanish culture. That's really great, in the same way that my mom was really interested in American Indian culture. So every time, like, my mom wasn't around, my grandmother would try to teach me Spanish, which I still don't really know. She'd be like, oh, napkin, servilleta, it's easy. And then she'd go away, and then my mom would come in, and she would say, I don't ever want to hear you speaking that language in the house, ever. If I ever hear you say a Spanish word, blah, 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 blah. So it was this constant tug of war, and as as I got older, it became almost impossible to navigate between those two sort of fierce titans, you know, in a way that also didn't do damage to me.
I mean, was it a matter of then choosing sides, sort of depending on what the issue was and what felt safest,
yeah,
perhaps?
Yeah, it was basically, there's a line in the book where I say it's like basically like a triangle trying to fit in a circle, and that's really how it was. Yeah. It was like, you know, using alliances and shifting between one or the other, because, you know, there were so many fights between them over so many different, like, you know, issues that they had personally, because I think my grandmother resented my mother living in the house. She didn't really pay rent. She just kind of like, you know, she created this own life that was entirely dependent on my grandmother. And at a certain point, my grandmother was old. She was tired. She wanted some peace. And I think I was often used as a negotiating totem, as it were.
You mentioned the fact that, and you write about the fact that she worked for a time as a phone sex operator. Allow her to sort of continue her storytelling, or even her lying about herself, that she could be somebody else on the other end of the phone.
Yeah, and if you believe my mother, the origin myth of how she became a phone sex operator was because I suggested it. So that's the story that she would tell people. Because, you know, invariably it would come out, she would tell her friends, and, you know, I was supposedly 10 or 11 years old, and we were all watching Donahue. You remember that old show? And they had phone sex operators on. And supposedly I leaned over to my mom and said, oh, you could do that. I don't know where I got that idea. I don't believe that story is true. I have a vague memory of it, but it's this thing where, like, she didn't have to take ownership for this sort of lifestyle choice that she made, because I had no idea what it was. But basically on the show, they had women that said, we can work from home, we make a lot of money, you know, we get to dominate the men that call us. And so maybe I did think, yeah, that my mom
could
do a
good
job of that. Yeah, exactly. So she started off slow. And, you know, the first few times, I think she threw up. Literally, it was a very uncomfortable experience for her. But I think she sort of tapped into that power where people could listen to her. As long as she kept talking, she had this sort of, like, she could basically save her life. She had, like, an outlet to express all of these anxieties and fears. And the extraordinary thing about it is that on the phone, she was an exceptional listener. Because, you know, back in the days before internet, it's like basically the average phone call, I believe, was somewhere around like 7 to 10 minutes. My mom could get men on for like 2, 3, 4 hours. You know,
by listening?
Just by listening. Yeah, you know. And of course, they charged by the minute back in those days. So, you know, they weren't talking. They didn't have a 4-hour sex call. It became almost like therapy. And it often makes me wonder, you know, maybe my mom had missed her calling. You know, maybe if she had taken some, you know, some courses or graduated from college, she could have had a different vocation.
Did you overhear those conversations about her end of that?
No, initially it was a very sort of sealed environment, and she was responsible in that way. She was basically, when the door is closed, you know, you don't come in here. What's going on is for adults. But she started to make so much money, she literally wouldn't leave to go to the bathroom or to get meals. So I would literally have to come in with a tray of food that my grandmother would make, and I would bring it in. And, you know, there's a sort of body anecdote. I won't repeat it. It's not safe for radio. But basically, yeah, I did hear some things that probably, you know, a 10 or 11-year-old child should not have heard.
But do you think she enjoyed the kind of power that she had over these anonymous men on the other end of the line?
I think that was a part of it. I mean, I don't feel that there is sort of this, like, you know, I'm going to take revenge against the male gender by, like, you know, blah, blah, blah. I think it came more of a place of, I'm finally being listened to. I'm special. I have something to offer. I think that was something that she felt was missing from her life. And, you know, I understand that. I mean, I think anyone can understand that sort of need to be validated in some specific way.
And she gave herself a name, Caroline.
Yeah, she sort of experimented, because one of the first things they taught her is that, you know, you have to assume an identity. So this whole idea of, like, online avatars, like, God, you know, I hate to say this, but if my mom had been around today for the internet, oh, shoot, catfishing everybody left and right, multiple Facebook accounts. But she had to come up with this identity, and so she finally settled on being this Irish grad student named Kara Lee. And, you know, it was weird, because we would have conversations after she got off the phone, and, you know, at dinner time, she would say, oh, Kara got asked to do this. And it was like, you know, wow.
Like this other person
that, like, basically was like, oh, okay, so now there are 4 people at dinner. There's, like, where my stepdad was, and then there's my grandmother, and then this other person, this other identity. And I feel like my mom got so invested in it, she really...
Yeah.
She wondered, I think she often wondered what it would have been like if she could go back and, like, somehow become this other person. It suited her quite well.
And there was a stepdad at the time? I mean,
yeah, there was a stepdad at the time. And I think that he also sort of, like, he was off doing his own thing. I believe it was Robert. He was, like, the second or third stepdad. It's in the book. But, yeah, he really just kind of, like, oh, you know, your mom does this thing. that's great. Leave her alone. She makes money.
And she did make money.
She did, yeah. She made like a quite a healthy amount because, again, it was all untaxed income. So I was, of course, one of the beneficiaries of that. You know, my mom, once she would work and then give the check, she didn't have even an opportunity to spend it. So she would give it to my grandmother. And then we'd go to movies, we'd go to bookstores. And that I really got obsessed and interested in pop culture and in, you know, the power, the transformative power behind books and behind narratives.
Her card said, "I'm the woman your mother warned you about."
Yeah.
She had a gift for words, did she not?
Oh, at a certain point, you know, she became so popular in the business, they had these little like cards. So they would send it out to their subscribers, basically, so their best customers. And, you know, there was a beautiful, I don't know who the woman was, but it was a gorgeous woman, you know, who, because my mom showed me, she's like, "Hey, look, I'm on this card." I'm like, "Wait, that's not you." This woman's 23. You know, she's wearing this low, you know, tight cut top. Like she's looked like, you know, she's very scantily dressed. And yeah, so it was this sort of weird caption. And I'll never forget it. I'm the woman that, you know, my mother told you about. But it's like, what if this woman was your mother? So
Exactly. Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Brando Skyhorse, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about his new book. It's a memoir called Take This Man. To join our conversation, give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. So were you, or even are you, a good liar yourself, or a colorful, imaginative, playful liar?
You know, I'd like, you know, I think sort of in my heyday, I experimented with sort of telling these like tall tales. You know, I eventually got out of Echo Park because I knew that intuitively I needed to go to college, and I eventually went to Stanford. Mm-hmm. And so I sort of experimented, you know, like other kids go to college, they experiment with drugs or alcohol. I experimented with storytelling, basically. Like I started telling these stories to friends, like, yeah, like, you know, I spent all my time on the Sunset Strip. I was a club kid, and like, you know, I grew up in this really dangerous neighborhood. I've seen gang killings, stuff, you know, just horrible, crazy stuff. And I was horrible at it. I was really just a terrible liar. I didn't have the conviction, and I realized over time that if you don't have the conviction behind your story, people will immediately realize them to be false. And
you have to believe your own lies in a way as you are telling them.
Yeah, I think so. And you also have to believe your own mythology behind it. And you also have to believe in the importance of why you're telling this story. So I think it became a natural extension for me to move into writing and working in both fiction and nonfiction. I had a wonderful nonfiction teacher named Jeffrey Wolf, and he would tell me basically the two kinds of storytelling. You know, fiction is for the things that you draw from your life that you'd like to change. That goes in this box here. But the things you absolutely cannot change, the heavier box you can't move without help, all that goes in the nonfiction box.
Oh, interesting.
So that's why all these materials, all these stories here are here, because I wouldn't have known how to tell this book slant. You know what I mean? I had to tell this the way it happened.
But here you are writing a memoir about a childhood and a name and people that were made up.
Yeah.
And the sort of lies that your mother told you about yourself. You have to, I mean, I realize you've spent your life sifting through this,
yeah, sure.
But also you have to figure out how to write about it.
Oh, yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, one of the things that was incredibly helpful, there was one sort of stable character throughout this book. His name is Frank. And basically, he's the man that I consider my father.
Right.
When I was 4 or 5, one of the first men that my mom dated after my father left was this guy named Frank. They worked together socially. And, you know, they really hit it off. The relationship didn't last long. That's like most of my mom's relationship didn't last. But he somehow wanted to stay in my life in some way. And so one of the book's through lines is us trying to negotiate this sort of very tenuous situation where he had no obligation to me. He wasn't my actual father, but he loved the idea so much of having a son. And he has no children of his now, unless you count me. So literally the book is also a chronicle of this sort of 30-year journey of how we learned to slowly accept each other as father and son. And it was really important for him to read a draft of this book to make sure, like, all the stuff that was like, you know, did this really happen? Did my mom do this? And he was like, oh, yeah, all this stuff is here. And he's read the book, and he's a huge fan. Every time I'm out in L.A. and I do an event, he goes there with his camera, and he puts it on Facebook and everything. But just to have somebody to corroborate the sort of survivor's account was just really, really crucial in putting this book together.
I don't think I'm giving too much away, but you do track down. I mean, actually, you Googled him, and you can find him in 10 minutes, but you did eventually track down on your quote-unquote biological father.
I did, and it was one of those things where it had been built up to such a degree that whatever my meeting would have been with him would not have met up to my expectations. But yeah, he took off when I was three, so I had no memories of him. All I had was his name. And I found him on whitepages.com, wrote him a letter, and he wrote me back, and then I had to go out and meet his family. He had been living 30 minutes away from us the entire time in a little town called Whittier, California. And so I went there, and, you know, the first thing that I realized when I looked at him, I was like, wait a minute, I don't really see an actual physical resemblance. And I thought, my mom's tricked me. Again, how did she do this? This is unbelievable. But then, you know, he showed me the photos and talked about his experiences with her. And, you know, he started a new family, you know, which made a lot of sense. And he has three daughters, you know, and I have three brand new sisters. And of course, as they were growing up, they would always tease him. It's like, oh, you know, you have daughters because, you know, you don't have a son. God's punishing you. They're just giving you daughters. And of course, he did have a son. They just didn't know that.
Yeah. I mean, do you know if he ever tried to find you or perhaps maybe watched you outside of your school walking around?
You know, I would have loved that, actually. I would love to be able to say that he did that. But no, I think what happened is that he just basically decided to put that life on the shelf. And, you know, I understand. I get that. He had to compartmentalize in order to move on. But I know that maybe, you know, in the past few years, he tried to make a feeble attempt to find me online, but I'd already changed my name. So there was no way that he could go and backtrack and try to figure things out. But, you know, we talk to each other about, you know, a couple times a year. I always see him when I'm out in L.A. So it's really good and very cordial and very friendly. But, you know, I am totally in love with my sisters because I didn't have siblings growing up. So the fact I now have this sort of like instant family after my mom and grandmother passed away in the 90s, that's really phenomenal to me.
In fact, you describe, I guess you're all sitting around a table or out together and you sort of look at them and you said, you know, you felt wanted, that they, and perhaps it just felt more quote unquote normal.
It was probably the first normal family get together I've ever been a part of. Like, it's really even difficult for me to think about it now without getting a little emotional, because it's the thing that I've like been searching for my whole life. And not to sugarcoat it in any way, it's like, you know, it's still a challenge because they have years and years of intimacies and inside jokes that I'll never know and I'll never be a part of. But they have been as open and as welcoming and as accommodating as you could ever want a family to be. So that for me is the happy ending, because it's a real ending.
And it's emotional because their emotions are so sort of maybe pure or just so apparent.
They're very, their emotions are very direct and uncomplicated. And after growing up in an extremely complicated background, it's just really kind of a relief to have a group of people to say, you know what, you're our family, you're our brother, we want to be your sisters, and that's that. There's no agendas. There's no sort of hidden motivations. It's just, it's a very sort of one-on-one kind of thing, which is just really, really fantastic and far more than I ever thought I would get when I went out to look for my father.
And I get about a minute before our second break here, but I guess also there's a truth to it, right?
Well, yeah, it's the the truth of it is that, you know, my mom, when she told me that, you know, I found out that, you know, I was a Mexican American when I was 12 or 13, she created all these fantastical sort of events for what happened to my father. Oh, the Mexican mafia kidnapped him, or, you know, all these sort of crazy things. And of course, the reality was that, no, he just moved on down the road, started a new life and started over. So it's interesting for me to think about what my mom would have made of this, because I'm sure she would have already been trying to figure out how to embellish it, how to make it bigger. You know, it doesn't need to be big. It doesn't need to be grandiose. It's just a very sort of simple reconciliation. And, you know, I'll take it.
That's Brando Skyhorse, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. And again, we're talking about his new book. It's a memoir called Take This Man. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. I should also add that his first book, titled The Madonnas of Echo Park, was awarded the Penn Hemingway Award for Debut Fiction. And this book takes place largely in Echo Park, a neighborhood in Los Angeles. 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Next time in Studio 360, how a kids' magazine took over American humor. Excuse me, is this Mad Magazine?
No, it's Mademoiselle. We're buying a sign on the installment plan.
The story of Mad Magazine from our series on American icons. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 10 on WHYY.
On the next Fresh Air, Bob Timberg tells us how his life was changed when he survived a landmine explosion in Vietnam, where he was serving as a Marine lieutenant. His disfigured face required multiple reconstructive surgeries. At first, he was afraid to let people see him, but he overcame that and went on to become a successful journalist. He's written a new memoir. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
It's a game of Senate hold'em across the country this election season.
Of the 36 Senate seats that are up this year, 21 of them are held by Democrats, many of them in red states. There's clearly going to be Republican pickups in November. The question is whether they get that net gain of 6.
How the deck is stacked for this year's battle for the Senate. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Brando Skyhorse. And just a recap here, his new memoir is titled Take This Man, and it chronicles his tumultuous childhood in the Los Angeles neighborhood of Echo Park. Through the untruths, or shall we say the lies, of his eccentric mother, he was led to believe that he was of Native American descent and that his father was an imprisoned political activist. None of it true. In years, he found out about his Mexican-American heritage and about the father who left his family. That's what we're talking about in this hour of Radio Times. And again, if you want to give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can send us a tweet at Marty Moss-Cohen, or you can just listen to our conversation, which is good enough as well. You mentioned the fact that your mother died, and you just certainly describe her death in this book. You were actually living in Brooklyn, I guess, or living in New York at the time.
Yeah, I was living in Jersey City, New Jersey,
Yeah. And you said, I didn't cry over my mother's death. I couldn't cry because I was incapable of crying. How come?
Yeah, that's, you know, it happened very suddenly. My mother had gained a lot of weight over the final years of her life. She started taking Fen-Phen, which, as you know, taken off, eventually off the market. And then she started cocktailing the Fen-Phen with speed because she had sort of been, you know, on and off prescription drug medication. And her heart basically gave out because she had lived a sedentary lifestyle. She was 50 years old, and I was completely unprepared for it. It hit me like a freight train. I spoke to her on a Saturday, and I believe she passed away on a Tuesday. And when I spoke to her, there was no, you know, sort of, there was nothing wrong. There was no distress in her voice at all. So to be able to try to process that information, like the first year, like I didn't leave the apartment, like I grew my hair out in an act of rebellion, because when I was growing up, like my mother always wanted me to wear my hair long, so to convince people that I was an American Indian. So my act of rebellion was to always cut it short because I didn't want long hair, because, you know, like I just, you know, that was my act of rebellion. So I grew my hair out. I gained a lot of weight. Wow. Yeah, it was a very difficult time. Very, very difficult.
And how did you help yourself through that?
Therapy, basically. Therapy. Yeah. I mean, I wish
nothing
it was some sort
that.
Of therapy and just an enormous amount of time. And, you know, what I learned in therapy, among other things, was like this belief that, like, you know, I was so defensive about talking about my mother to my therapist. For the first year and a half, I didn't even acknowledge to her that I had a dysfunctional childhood. Like, I was saying, well, everyone has a crazy family.
Mother,
yeah, of course. Absolutely. I was in total, like, defensive protection mode. And even now, to have written a book and to be talking about it makes me feel like, oh, you know, like, what would my mother say?
Right.
Blah, 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 blah. So, yeah, it was a very complicated set of dismantling all of these sort of dysfunctional things that I barricaded myself with because I didn't know any other way.
But did you have to figure out how you loved your mother, or how you made it through your childhood, or sort of reconcile the things that were told to you that weren't true?
Those all came in steps, because I think, you know, the fact that my mother passed away, that was such an enormous step to kind of deal with. And then literally 18 months later, my grandmother passed away. So I was just starting to come out of that box when my grandmother, who was also I was a little bit closer to, she passed away. And it was also, it wasn't quite as sudden, but it was fast. Like, it just hit me, like, just, I didn't really have any time to recover. So once I got through those steps of, you know, accepting the fact that they were gone and that I was sort of free, because I certainly had those fantasies growing up where I was like, I hate my life. I hate being prisoner here. I hate the fact that I'm connected to these people. It's like, what happens when you get that wish? I'd wished my mom and my grandmother gone, dead, vanished so many times. I got my wish. And all of a sudden, like, what do I do now? Like, am I culpable? Am I responsible? So it took an enormous amount of time to sort of just get through that process. And then once I got through that process, I could accept the fact, okay, I had a complicated childhood. How do I become a more reasonable and rational adult?
You write here, and there's so much in this book that it just touched me, moved me. You said, I'm intact, but the scars are there. Some from a losing battle with acne that gave me pimples on my 40th birthday are easy to see, others aren't. Then you say, I'm irresistibly drawn to people from my past in spite of the challenges of reestablishing contact and the inevitable pain when they drift out of my life again. I'm prone to hurting people and being hurt by people who hurt people. I can disappear from contact with friends for weeks or months at a time. I have severe chronic and undiagnosed stomach problems. There are intimacy concerns and abandonment issues. Still true today?
Absolutely. Yeah. And I think that, you know, one of the things that was really important to me in writing this book, you know, if anyone out there is listening, you know, wow, crazy family, but why would I be interested and why would I want to read this? This book is basically a lesson in empathy and understanding. Mm-hmm. So if anybody has those sort of issues with their family for any reason, you know, just read through the book. If I can get through my issues with my family, you can get through your issues with your family. But that came from empathy, and that came from an acceptance of the fact that these people were flawed. These people were damaged. I'm a flawed, damaged person, and it would be foolish of me to say, yeah, you know, I had this really chaotic lifestyle, but everything's better now. I feel that we're often conditioned by reading narratives like this, that when you get through the sort of hard stuff, somebody's surviving, it's all hunky-dory, and it's not. Right. The fact that you're surviving every day, that's all you get. And if you're lucky to get anything else beyond that, well, you know, great. That's a really phenomenal thing. But most of us have to go through the hard work of dealing with this damage and compartmentalizing it and making sure that you don't fall back into the same old toxic patterns.
Do you like the word dysfunctional? Often ascribed to families probably like yours.
I wish there was a shorter word.
Yeah,
I wish there was something
it's
punchier.
It's an ugly word.
It is a really ugly word. And also the fact fun is in it. I just really hate that for some reason. I know that's a stupid thing to say. But yeah, I wish there was a way to convey that, because it sounds so stock. It sounds so predictable. And of course, you know, everyone's family is dysfunctional. Mm. Obviously, maybe not to the extent of my family, but everyone's family, almost by definition, they're meant to basically not work, because you have different agendas. You're all different people. So it's challenging. It's really challenging.
This is a cliched question, but has writing helped you? I mean, you've just written a memoir.
Yeah, a novel, of course. I mean, it's one of those things where I feel like, you know, I could not have become anything else except a writer. And, you know, in terms of financial security, maybe not the best career choice in the world, but, you know, in terms of being able to communicate, you know, these stories, which were certainly, you know, it was helpful for me, it was cathartic for me, and I'm already getting responses from people. I think the book is connecting with the people who have found their way to it. That's enormously gratifying. And it's, I guess it's one of those things, at the end of the book, I say that stories can save your life. And I'm a genuine believer in that, that basically narrative is breath. The stories that you have, the stories that we tell to sustain ourselves, that's how we get through the day. That's how we create our lives. That's what gets passed on, you know, from generation to generation. And that's certainly what saved me.
You have a section here. You also say, in a memoir, a day of your life can be a long chapter, a month, a single line of prose. A year can be a text break or an entire blank space. I really like that.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, you get to sort of rewrite your life, I guess.
Yeah. Well, you know, if I could rewrite it, believe me, it would be one page long, and it would be like, you know, Brando had one father and one mother, and they lived in Echo Park, the end. That would be the perfect book. I would totally accept that and embrace that.
Probably wouldn't be a writer.
I probably would not be a writer, but I would definitely trade it all away. I get to analyze the parts of my life and try to understand why things happened the way they did. I can't rewrite the things that I wish hadn't happened out, but I can accept the facts that I can look at why things happened the way that they did and hopefully try to learn and understand from that.
Your mom says at one point, after, I guess, all these five fathers and other men in your life, you're so lucky. You had five fathers. There's some people don't have one father. You're so lucky.
Yeah, she said, you know, that's plenty for one boy. What's the matter with you? And I think that she really felt that up to the very end that she was doing the best that she could to provide me a specific kind of lifestyle that was, for lack of a better word, you know, it wasn't boring. And it, you know,
wasn't
it sure
boring.
As heck wasn't.
And Echo Park, where you grew up, I mean, we're in Philadelphia, that's in Los Angeles. How would you describe that neighborhood? Then we'll get Jackie to join us.
Yeah, sure. No, the neighborhood, you know, in the 1920s and 30s was sort of very opulent, rich. It was where all these movie stars used to live. And then it just fell into sort of general disarray. And by the time I was living there in the 70s, you know, it was basically Latinos, Vietnamese, working class people, because white flight had basically, you know, people had just abandoned the area. And now it's completely gentrified. So the circle is basically complete again. So now they're like craft beer bars and fashionable boutiques. And like, you know, I go back there. Every time I go back to LA, I go through the neighborhood and like, I recognize it, but I don't recognize it. You know what I mean? Like I see like, oh, that used to be the old 99-cent store. Now they're serving $8 sandwiches there. That's really amazing. I never thought I'd see it, but it's a really fantastic thing.
Is your house still there?
It's still there. It's still there.
Is it gentrified? Or
you know, they put some plants out there. I haven't taken a tour of it, but yeah, it's still there. And I still have those same complicated feelings. Like a part of me wants to go in, and a part of me's like, you know what? I'm going to stay away.
Yeah, which may be the best thing to do.
Probably.
Let me get Jackie from Lehigh Valley to join us on Radio Times. Jackie, go ahead. You're on the air. Do we have Jackie?
This is a fascinating sort of ethnographic kind of look at coming out into who you are. And the thing that's fascinating to me is whereas, you know, most people can look into their past to find sort of that, you know, that diamond in the rough, you know, that sort of gem, you've kind of gone into your past and that was sort of surrounded with all these sort of fantastical stories and had to go back into finding, you know, something that was very, you know, where you came from as being very normal. And I just think it's a sort of a fascinating version of
like a fairy tale or something. Yeah, Jackie, thanks for the call. Brandon, go ahead.
Yeah, no, thank you. I wanted to focus a little bit on what that phrase you used, coming out, because I think
scribbled that down myself.
It's a very apt description. And you know, coming out in so many ways, coming out and talking about my family, coming out and talking about the fact that, you know, among other things, which we'd really even gotten a chance to discuss, that I didn't really know that I wasn't an American Indian until I was 12 or 13, and so I sort of had to hide that from people. And, you know, when I was in high school, I started dating someone who was a Vietnamese girl. And I figured, like, well, we've been together 6 weeks. I'm clearly going to be with for the rest of my life. So I'm going to tell her the truth. And she dumped me. And she dumped me because I was a Mexican. And then, like, I had to tell all my friends in high school, oh, hey, well, this is what happened. And so I basically had to come out as a Mexican-American. And most of my friends were like, oh, weird, but okay. So, like, that phrase, that idea of, like, you know, these secrets that you have and, like, how do you deal with those secrets and safeguarding it, because, you know, for all the stories that my mother told, she could be incredibly secretive, and I would, you know, I would feel that backlash, like if I even let, like, you know, if I deviated 1 centimeter from, you know, the prepared text that she had for me. So it's been really gratifying to kind of like put all this in a book and be able to talk about it now.
I guess because coming out is coming clean in a certain kind
of way. It is. And accepting the fact that, you know, unlike, you know, the reaction that my high school girlfriend had, which again, of course, I completely understand because her family was bullied by Mexicans. So, of course, she would just respond in that really gut kind of primal way that, you know, the truth in the end always has to come out. So you have to be comfortable with it.
I'd love to have you read another section from the book, and this is a little different, and this is something that your mother wrote.
Yeah, my mother for years was working on a book, and you know, the pages were kind of a mess, so if you looked at the typeset pages, it's all left margin justified, like something like if the Unabomber had a typewriter, basically this is what it looked like. So I was able to clean up a bit of it, and it was a real honor and privilege for me to get this one piece of typeset text in this book for her. You might as well know that I'm not looking at my mistakes, and I'm sorry about that. No one wants to hear anything bad about one's own family. I've sinned. Who hasn't? I did a lot of foolish things to be loved. I'm surprised I wasn't killed. I used to pick up all kinds of men because I was bored at home. Or maybe I was lonely. I wonder why I never focused on the people close to me. Why did I go looking for people who were so far away? I don't know why I can't be honest with anybody. For a very long time in life, I wanted to give up. I'm not feeling sorry for myself. If anything, I'm feeling mad. No more rages, though. Well, I can't say that. But I can say love looks a lot different as you grow older. Brando, I did a lot of things for you, and because of you. I could have left you many times, but I didn't. You're all I ever wanted in a child. I know you don't think I did enough as a mother, but as you can see now, I had no choice but to share you with others and the rest of this world. There's too much to do, too much to see. Make a lot of noise. I haven't really gone anywhere in such a long time because I wanted to feel safe. If anyone takes anything away from this book, it's this. Don't waste your life hiding away like I did.
Mm, that's so powerful. Do you think she was writing that for you, for herself, for posterity? Who was she writing for?
I'm pretty sure it wasn't for me.
You're in there, though.
Yeah, I'm in there. I'm definitely in there. I think she was writing for a sense of, again, probably validation. I think she was writing, you know, to try and save her life. And if you look through the pages, the material, it just goes on and on. But like that core element of like, you know, having wasted her life and trying to figure out what it was that made her tick. I think even in the end, she understood that she had a lot of fundamentally damaged issues, but she was still a good person and still a good-hearted person and was still looking for that peace and solace. And, you know, I know it sounds cliche to say, but she passed away a number of years ago. I know for a fact that wherever she is now, at least she's at peace. And I could take some small comfort in that.
What was it like to edit her work? I mean, you've worked as an editor.
Yeah, I worked in publishing for a number of years. And, you know, I'm a book editor, and I still do it from freelance from time to time. And it was an extraordinary challenge because it was a mess. So looking at it from an objective standpoint, just trying to find out, like, you know, what the core emotions were. There was so much to strip through. But basically, you know, as my mother would always say, you know, at least it's never boring. So I kind of just focused on, like, really what I thought was the core, you know, sort of message of it. And I feel like in one sort of significant way, that whole idea, don't waste your life hiding away. You know, my mom felt that she was taking the safe and practical approach to basically not interacting with the world or trying to control the world too much. And she learned basically that was a mistake.
We're almost out of time here, an unfair question, but I wonder what she would have thought of this book.
You know, she would leave a 5-star review on Amazon saying, this is the best book ever. And then half an hour later, she'd leave a 1-star review saying, everything in this book is false. Come to me for the real story.
It's been such a pleasure to have you on Radio Times. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you so much. I had a great time.
A great time for us as well. And again, Brando Skyhorse, our guest. And his new book is a memoir titled Take This Man. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about this program, including downloading podcasts and following us on Twitter and Facebook. You can also check out the archives and listen to us on satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, our intern this summer is Ariel Plotnick, and the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us.